I'm Erling Jorsted, and we're here for a forum on a night when the wind seems to be blowing, and if people hear this tape somewhere along the line, years from now, they'll know that everybody says here are the old-timers anyway, and you can tell us on this that this is very unusual weather for this area. So I was just talking about the fact that there doesn't seem to be unusual weather here because all the weather is unusual every day. But anyway, tonight the title is what I call it the Church and the New Politics, and the paper I'm going to read requires a little explanation because some time ago I was asked by the editors, Lowell Allman and Don McClellan of the Lutheran Standard, to write a paper on this particular subject, with the idea being that this would be the first of a series which the Standard wants to inaugurate, that is to have what we call a position paper on a given topic. I'm going to take a stand on this, and then what is happening now, a couple months ago, and Don is having three or four people respond in briefer form to this particular paper, and then my paper plus three or four shorter responses will be in the Lutheran Standard in probably July or maybe early August or something else like that. So what you're hearing tonight in a sense is a preview, but I would certainly welcome your response because I'm going to make my statement. It's a six-page paper with wide margins, or narrow margins, I should say. That's better, isn't it? Narrow margins. When I tell my students I want a six-page paper, one student sent in a paper with a margins of 35 and 40, and said that that was a six-page paper. Kate, you've got a couple like that, more than a couple. All right. So anyway, we have an influx here. Anyway, what I don't like to read manuscripts, right off the page because I like what speech teachers like to call significant eye contact. But I have to say tonight that even though these words aren't cast in stone, they are at least cast in typecast right now. Somewhere in that great vast land known as Lutheran Standard at 426 South Fifth Street, 55415. Minneapolis. All right, so I'll read it as I wrote it, and then we'll have lots of opportunity for discussion. And it's going to be hard because some of you know I like to tell stories, and it's going to be hard just to read this. So I'd like one form. I'm trying out some things before I start it, I have to tell. Would it be, possible to have, tell your favorite Garrison Keillor Lake Wobegon stories one night? I think everybody could bring their favorite stories. I've got several. Because one night, when was it? I can't remember. Maybe you were here, Kate, when 76, whenever it was. What we did for an evening entertainment, we simply brought our favorite stories. You were there, right. Yeah, wonderful night. And anybody under 30 could, they were just overwhelmed. This was so much fun. Why hadn't people told us about this?
We had a joke night one night.
Joke night, yeah.
A Norwegian that could tell.
Yeah, good.
Ole Lina story.
Oh, well, depends on how far you go with Ole Lina stories. All right, anyway, but that might be fun because Garrison Keillor does so well, and he must have known my Norwegian Lutheran minister when I grew up because his Reverend Enquist is absolutely perfect. It just couldn't be him better. And Father Emil with Our Lady of Perpetual Responsibility and all the rest. I have to get to my paper. All right. And if you haven't, sometimes, get the Prairie Home Companion, look it up on your educational broadcasting radio network, and it's excellent. So I think I'll propose that for a forum sometime. Not a forum, but just an entertainment topic for the evening. I entitled this for the article, and I'll go straight here. I entitled this, Faith and Politics, A Recipe for Action. Will Rogers once said that the fastest way to start an argument with a fellow American was to criticize his recipe for mixing faith and politics. That Oklahoma pundit had good reason to believe that the interaction of faith and politics has produced sharp controversy in this country. Over the decades, Americans have done battle with one another with invocations for support to God, the Bible, Martin Luther, and countless intermediaries as they debated capitalism, foreign policy, religion in the public school, tax exemption, among other disputes. In our times, these controversies have been fueled by new and exceedingly complicated emotional forces, reminding us that Rogers' recipe for argumentation is being widely used across the 50 states. Faith and politics, church and state issues, are commanding not only page one coverage in the media, but are today briskly heating up the dialogues within organized American religious life. Everyone, as usual, has a recipe but agreement as to the best one seems far down the road. In this article, I attempt to identify the causes of this new escalation, to locate the issues that we as Lutherans, as well as other Americans, are debating, to suggest some guidelines for our arguments with our neighbors, and finally, to explain why all of this is a part of our responsibility as people of faith. The current debates have been heightened because largely they focus on two complicated critical issues. First, foreign policy, and second, public morality. First, foreign policy. The debate over increasing public revenues for both traditional armaments and over the use of nuclear weapons has swept through the American church scene with an intensity and conviction rarely known before. So intense is the feeling over the freeze issue, for instance, that it has cut across and even demolished older commitments such as conservative, moderate, or liberal, or being, quote, born again, or Catholic, or mainstream, has little to do with how a believer stands on the freeze proposals. In recent months, this intensity has been fueled by two highly important sources. First, by President Reagan, who, when speaking to the National Association of Evangelicals, said, "There is sin and evil in the world, and we are enjoined by Scripture and the Lord Jesus to oppose it with all our might," close quote. Soviet communism, quote, "is the focus of evil in the modern world," he stated, "and those who favor a mutual freeze on new nuclear weapons ignore the aggressive instincts of an evil empire," close quote. Many people of faith in this country were surprised in anger over so sectarian and so categorical an interpretation by the leader representing all of America. Others found in his words what they have wanted for a long time to hear from their president. A second source of intensity over foreign policy has been the escalating criticisms of the social outreach policies of the National Council of Churches, this by the Reader's Digest and by Morley Safer in his television program 60 Minutes. This too divides Americans into camps where common ground is hard to find. Critics of the National Council argue that now is the time for the nation to understand how politically ideological some National Council programs are, especially those which fund dissent activities in third world trouble spots. Defenders of the National Council point to the oversimplified, polemical, and equally ideological content of such criticisms which spread, they state, falsehoods if not outright lies. Beyond foreign policy, Americans are locked into acrimonious debate over the role of the churches in public morality issues. Since its rapid and energetic appearance in the political campaigns of 1980, the moral majority has helped escalate the argument among church people over the proper role of denominations on matters of social morality. Its list of demands are pro-life, pro-religious exercises in the public schools, pro-legal restraints on the civil rights of homosexuals, anti-extension of the Equal Rights Amendment, and pro-increased spending for weapons, and all this has focused wide public concern over the question of where, how, and even if denominations as such should present proposals based on their doctrinal convictions. On this, the moral majority's agenda. The same question of church involvement shows up with bitter intensity over a variety of other issues. Creationism, protection of the environment, gun control, busing, tax exemption for private school students, targeting television programs, secular humanism, the list goes on at length. Again, these are no longer conservative or liberal issues, as Americans have known them. So, in both foreign policy and in public morality questions, today we find Americans locked in vigorous, often harsh conflict over what should be the response of people of faith to these matters. And it seems that they are growing in intensity. Time, the great healer, has not softened the edges. Indeed, charges straight from the 1950s, such as soft on communism, are heard with increasing force. To sum up, we have no agreement on the recipe. As people of faith, what might our response be? Here are some reminders, suggestions, guidelines, a series of starting points which may help sharpen the focus of our conversations with one another. And these are made in no particular order of priority. First, avoid the temptation of remaining silent in hope that things will settle down before an argument develops. Secondly, avoid the temptation of asking, what has faith to do with politics? Such passivity fails to harmonize with what churches have done for centuries. That is, they have spoken directly about faith and politics. Churches have consecrated, for instance, too many wars and endorsed too many disastrous ventures of imperialism. Churches have silenced scientists and chastised artists. Churches have sought favors for themselves from governments. In America, churches have enacted sectarian morality at the expense of religious freedom. And churches have remained silent despite the presence of slavery and other forms of ethnic and sexual prejudice. In other words, never has the church remained silent. Third, remember that the faith, the gospel, is controversial. That understanding should neither alarm nor unnerve us. Controversy often is unpleasant, divisive, but it is basic to the condition of being human. One can only wonder with sadness what the lost opportunities for witnessing to the world have been because church people feared controversy. Fourth, keep in mind that we, readers of this journal, belong to a denomination. Now, that is not news, but being in a denomination means a conscious decision by us to respect and hold up differences of understanding, judgment, and priority from fellow members. Denominations are not sects where unity really means uniformity. Denominations do have their authentic sources of unity, which gives them the freedom to honor as legitimate the recipes of those with differing perspectives. We say we honor this freedom. Today's controversies give us the opportunity to show us that we really do. Fifth, recognize the danger of believing that those in positions of government have, quote, all the facts and therefore know best what to do. Or putting it another way, who are we to disagree with our leaders who have all that information gathering apparatus, you know, at their disposal? By way of reply to that suggestion, we remember some instances where having the facts has proved disastrous. The Bay of Pigs fiasco, the Tonkin Bay falsehoods, and the incursion into Cambodia, you know, come to mind. All three decisions were made by presidents who had the facts, and all three turned into disasters and nightmares. Sixth, avoid the temptation to believe that we shouldn't make decisions until all the facts are in. To that we can say, at what point in history dealing with public policy are all the facts in? This list can be extended at length. What we consider in this last section is our responsibility of people of faith to become involved. First, as believers, we choose our priorities. We choose, let's say here, disarmament and waging war on oppression and injustice. The biblical mandate for such priorities, I think, is self-evident. We know we cannot begin to minister to such programs by ourselves or in small numbers. So we find others, partners in the faith, who share our interest. But we may have some differences over immediate commitments, over specific details, or over the language which they seem to prefer to ours. Should we then negate our commitment to our priorities? I think not. Once we commit ourselves to peacemaking and justice, we commit ourselves to doing so in community. Second, assuming that we agree on that point, then how specific should our churches be in their involvement in public policy making? Should they concentrate on general principles? Should they advocate specific legislative or diplomatic proposals? Or is there some kind of middle ground? Here the words of William Temple, a famous English church leader from 1881 to 1944, are helpful, and I quote him at length. The church is committed to the everlasting gospel and to the creeds which formulate it. It must never commit itself to an ephemeral program of detailed action. Temple went on to advocate that the church proclaim ethical principles together with denunciations of institutions and practices which violated these principles. When a person knew what was wrong, he was in a better position to know what was right. Our faith informs us mightily on what is wrong. From there, we are on a secure path in arriving at what is right. Third, as Christians, we keep in mind that God has called us to witness in all areas of life, not in some separate sphere we call religious. Hence, we do not serve him in spiritual life while serving mammon in economic life. We don't worship God in temples, but something else in political centers. Our personal and our social witnesses are one and the same. Fourth, we recognize that in all the bewildering complexity and heated controversy of finding the recipe, that we do have our sources of inspiration and renewal. The challenge comes from Christ, simply but profoundly in the Beatitudes, in the parables, in the petition, "Thy kingdom come." When faithful to its witness, the church will live with controversy and without self-righteousness. Finally, we recall the words of W.A. Visserhoft, General Secretary of the World Council of Churches, words written in 1966, and I close with this quotation. First, that from the days of Amos to the days of Martin Luther King, the fiercest criticism of the people of God has come from within the churches. Secondly, that we do not speak because we want to have a say in the affairs of the world, but because we cannot live with God, with our fellow men, with ourselves, if we keep silent. Complete. 30, as they would say in journalism. So I invite your response, comment. If you want to write to Lowell right away and tell them to, you know, scrub it. 612-334-3140 if you want to call Lowell. Okay. I'd really invite your comments on this, though, because I did take a stand, I want you to know.
That third one in the first group of things.
I'll repeat that, right.
Remind me of something that I...
Remember that the gospel, the faith is controversial. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there was a Methodist bishop up here about a week ago. And he said the biggest problem that he had in all of the work that he did was lack of courage on the part of his pastors, because the Methodist Church has very strong stands in writing on certain issues. And the pastors just lack the courage to preach on those issues and say, this is where we stand, and it's a problem.
What happened in the, you know, in some places in the civil rights issue, and I remember this well because we had at Holden here for several years, we had Al Pitcher, who was very much involved in the movement in Chicago. And you remember he worked with King directly and so on. It is happening now too. And Dan, I wish Dan were here because he could tell some stories about when he preached his first anti-Vietnam sermon, and he found that he lost his largest donor to the church.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. The church is a voluntary agency. Thank goodness we don't want the government, you know, to, like an established church, to fund the churches. But the church leadership and the rest find themselves at the mercy of the parishioners. When you would hear, for instance, in Chicago, a civil rights sermon being preached, you would find buttons instead of envelopes in the collection plate. That's a tough one.
Did you hear much where you live about Archbishop Kunthausen and the income tax problem? This created waves and waves in this archdiocese. Uh-huh. Believe you me, I go to the Jesuit church on Saturday.
I see.
And the Jesuits are very supportive of him in their usual freewheeling, liberal ways,
right, as I
know them in Tacoma. I wonder how much of that reached you, where you are the stand of this archbishop,
not
withholding money from his taxes.
None.
Being used, yeah, for nuclear weapons.
Yeah, right. That I was interested last night in the movie for the tapes. The Gods of Metal is the Mary Knoll movie. That's the title of it, right? That we're referring to here, that was shown here at the Village last night. And I was very impressed with that because that has not caught on, in as far as I know, in the Middle West. Here from Mora. I'm sorry, it hasn't. I'd like to see it. What we do have on the other side is Archbishop Roach, who's National Chairman of the National Council of Catholic Bishops, and he's the Archbishop in the St. Paul Minneapolis Diocese, and has taken the lead now in getting the third draft of the peace proposal through. So maybe they're concentrating their efforts in a different area there, but it's not. And the Jesuits aren't especially strong in the Middle West.
No, I think she meant, did you get the publicity where you were about what our bishop here did?
No, we didn't.
Mm-hmm. Interesting thing about.
Yeah, here's another Minnesotan, right?
Roach is that he's as well respected by Protestants,
yeah,
throughout the state of Minnesota, mm-hmm, and surrounding states as,
yeah,
he is by his own Roman Catholic constituency, which is great.
Well, I think Hunthausen is more respected than he is by his own colleagues.
Good.
The rest of us appreciate him.
Yeah, I'm sorry that hasn't happened, Kate, but that just, I'm grateful that.
I almost beg the publication such as the National Catholic Report.
Yes.
Because if you really read this regularly, you become very alert to liberal issues and non-liberal statements,
yes,
I might say. Mm-hmm. There's a real punch to that.
Yeah.
Is anybody here not reading the National Catholic Reporter, I would wave it in your faces.
Is it true what I said here, from your experience, that given, say, the Freeze issue, that this is not a liberal, conservative, radical, or anything else? It's just enlists people from the entire political spectrum? I mean, let me put it this way, has it brought out people who are getting involved who haven't been speaking up on other issues before very much, from your...
The tax thing did.
Yeah, the tax thing. Because I'm curious, and I would be very interested in who is participating in the movement. Is it one more cause, that we add to the, that we add to the list, or is this something that, because of the dimension of the Freeze issue that is there, that is bringing out people who might otherwise have been, more quiet?
The initial report of this Pasadena meeting that took place last week,
yeah,
indicated that there really was some confusion. There were no clear lines at all, and that it was a mishmash. You couldn't differentiate between liberal and conservative at all. The whole issue was very confused,
yeah,
and no one could get a line on where anyone was by what they were saying.
I'm delighted to hear that, because usually when critics of a movement can sort of identify an ideological strain of, say, just liberals out doing their thing, just like they used to do for some of the other things, and therefore they can dismiss it. You know, or the same thing can be said about the conservatives. I study conservatives, and sometimes I'm tempted when I see conservatives doing their thing, aha, that's just the latest fad for the conservatives, without giving them credit for perhaps being serious, you know, about what they're doing. Yeah, Joel?
Well, what I see is you listed a list of things that the moral majority of. I see people buying part of that list, but not part. I see that that isn't, at least in our area, that that's not being, that's not going down as a whole. Mm-hmm. That there will be people who, for instance, will be pro-life and nothing else.
Yeah.
Or there will be people who will be upset about homosexuality in some context, but nothing else.
Yeah.
And I don't see that there's a lot of success in getting all of that. Yeah. So that I think that's part of the confusion. Why people are there maybe for one thing on the
right,
list, or they are perhaps staying away because of one thing.
Yeah, that's what's happened is that I've done, some of you know I do a lot of adult forums on Sunday morning. And when I do the one on the moral majority, people say, I really want to get involved on because of this one issue, such as one you mentioned, but I can't buy the whole package because that's identified with Jerry Falwell.
Right.
And so they stay away from that.
I've heard a good one,
Tommy Tyson, none of you probably know. Tommy Tyson, he's a coach for the basketball
team. He said, something about, I don't want to criticize Mr. Falwell. All I can say is I hope he's right. I hope the majority are moral.
California have a little bumper sticker that says the moral majority is neither.
I've got a t-shirt some student gave me, Jerry is a jerk, but
was that the Brown or was that
No, not Jerry Brown.
Okay.
I think he's deserves, he's finally been accorded the oblivion he so richly deserves. So.
The feeling and the thought that has been expressed to me in terms of the creed by lay and clergy alike, is the fact that the priest does not do enough. And therefore, a lot of people are not supporting the priest program as such, and they would rather, and the division comes at the point where they would say, priest, yes, we're going to go beyond that. We want to go back and de-escalate what we already have, dismantle some of the things we already assembled.
Well, I hope they don't get bogged down in tactics. You know, that would be frightening. But I you know, they're saying we have to dismantle. That's what they're calling for. Boy, that raises a question, a very serious question about tactics and about the peace movement, for instance, in the late 60s. And I can remember so well debating some people, and I have reference to people here, for instance, like Bill Coffin and the Berrigan brothers and all the others. One criticism that's been made of the peace leaders in the late 60s, the Berrigans, Bill Coffin and the others, is that they didn't take the time to build grassroots support for the movement. They moved ahead very quickly. And there were a lot of people who resented the fact that they seemed to be sort of generally supportive of what the leaders were trying to do, but it'll take a longer period of time to do this. And I'm afraid that if, in all the certainly commendable enthusiasm for dismantling, they don't stop to build enough support, you know, on the grassroots level. It takes time. There's, frankly, I'll say this, and you know, I support the bear against most of the things, but sometimes building on the grassroots level is not very glamorous or exciting or media gaining, and it takes work. Laura, I don't know if you remember George Olson in our congregation. I probably shouldn't put this on tape, but anyway, he and I once after, well, the gospel is controversial, and we had a dandy controversy. This is when we're living on Winona Street. And because on this exact issue, when I said, you know, we have to get involved, you know, in all this, and I didn't take the time to sit down and sort of reason with George. Maybe it wouldn't have helped, I don't know. But because, you know, I was more in enthused about getting things done right now. And I think that's where a lot of work has to be done.
I think sometimes they suffer from a sort of a star quality.
There's some,
I'm sure they don't mean to.
No.
I'm sure
but then on the other hand, if you saw the movie Gandhi, you know you have to have publicity. Gandhi was, I mean, I think most of us saw, you know, the movie. Mm-hmm. Gandhi knew full, that's why he had Margaret Burke White. He couldn't have gotten a better, you know, source for publicity. You have to have publicity because you can't build a mass movement until you get the masses, knowledgeable. Yeah, and there's the trick. And, some very, 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 it's a very difficult kind of problem.
But I think the grassroots can't be limited to just this country. It has to be worldwide.
And that's what's so interesting. We saw the movie last night in your comments, too, that the greatest number of people in the movement have come from Western Europe. 500,000 marched in Madrid?
750,000 in Madrid.
750 in Madrid.
Yeah, what happened in Madrid?
Well, one thing I think is just my interpretation is that there has always been a movement for this kind of humane progressive change, and it's just now in the last few years under a constitutional monarch that they've had the opportunity to do so, because under Franco for a long time, the lid was on for such a long time they didn't have the opportunity to express it. And now I promised King, what's his name?
Carlos,
that's right, King Carlos. They have the opportunity to do these things, and I think there is a very large outpouring there. And of course, it's very strong in, you know, West Germany, East Germany too, we found out. And
you know what it seems like, that people sort of take time to don't want to think, and so they try not to about this, and they mull it over anyway. And then finally, something happens, like the thing you mentioned of the sheriff's chasing the
Amish
children in
right.
the cornfields,
yeah.
or Bull Connor with his fire hose
right.
and police dogs,
yeah.
and then finally, that's just the last straw.
Because
I can remember in the civil rights movement, Vietnam, I remember seeing a soldier dragging himself and holding his hand up and saying, "Oh God," and I said, "Boy, that is it. I mean, that's it. You know, we're hitting the bricks because."
I thought it was when the Vietnam vets stood in front of some place in Washington and threw their medals back at the government again. Remember that one? I thought, you know, that's going to get the American public if nothing else did, and it didn't.
One of the things that got me about the nuclear thing was we were talking up here at Holden about first strike weapons, and that was kind of new to me. I had heard about it during a peace conference at PLU just once before that, and it just didn't even occur to me that America would make first strike weapons. It was just so far beyond my thinking. But anyhow, there was a man who took some hostages at the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C., and he had a van, and he said it was full of dynamite and that he was going to blow up the Washington Monument.
I remember that, yes.
Well, you know what happened to him? They shot him in
right.
cold blood because they thought he was going to blow up something. They thought
that.
He was.
Right.
And it came to my mind that if the police will just cold-bloodedly murder this man because they think he's going to blow them up, and here we stand with all these weapons, they think we're going to blow them up, you know, are they going to shoot us?
Right.
It's
frightening.
Yeah,
frightening.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, we live in the Quad Cities, and the greatest industry there is the Rock Island Arsenal. And really, you just can't even talk to people about thinking about quitting the jobs there. It's just, you know, it's almost as if they compartmentalize. It's almost as if, you know, I can agree with everything you say, but then when you talk about my job, it's almost like the Germans went on being German and didn't.
Yeah. Well, in Minneapolis, there was demonstrations because with Honeywell, and they had including it's a wonderful story. Maybe it got around on the national wires. The wife of the chief of police, and the chief of police had to come down and arrest his wife, but he respected her. Tony Musa, that's his name, right? And Erica is not her name, and you could sort of feel that he really respected her, and she's not going to pay bail either. So the wife of the chief might be in jail this summer, which. You know, the one thing that was kind of good in Minneapolis, nobody really got excited about it. There weren't any fiery letters denouncing. But anyway, on the Honeywell thing, there was a strong peace movement, largely through the churches, through a very liberal Catholic church, Father Egan. But they demonstrated, and then they were carried away and all the rest. And then Honeywell said no more demonstrations after this. And then the reporters asked them, what about the major thrust of the argument or the demonstration, the argument of the demonstrators? And they said somebody has to manufacture the weapons. It's going to be done, so that's why we're going to do it, because somebody has to do it. That and it was this sort of fatalistic. No, is that? But I think that has put them on the defensive. I think that's kind of a step in the right direction. You find very few of the mad bombers left anymore. I remember in the late 50s and the rest, there used to be little buttons that you'd hang, you'd have, and they would take the peace symbol, and then they would sort of make it into a symbol for a B-52, and then they would, underneath it, would say, "Drop it." Those were my friends on the far right that I was studying, at that time, and gave me some difficulties. But I think that if you take, for instance, the civil rights movement, which really didn't get anywhere until the churches got involved in the mid-60s, and you take the peace movement in the late 60s and the early 70s, which it's still too early to tell, you know, how much effect that had, but it did make it much more difficult for the traditional sort of tub thumpers to be critical. I think that was another step. And my feeling is that the peace movement today is going to rise or fail to the extent to which it has support, you know, from the organized religions or religious communities in this country. I really think that's where it's at. Doug Reagan is having a terrible time because he comes up with this kind of incredible rhetoric, a little bit of which I read tonight. And Jim Wall, the Christian editor of the Christian Century, says that what's happened is that Reagan, you know, obviously people write his speeches, as every president has people writing speeches, and he gives these speeches, and everybody sort of shudders a little bit, and then they put him away and they pretend that it didn't happen, including Reagan. It's just sort of something that he has to go through. But he's having a terrible time because he can't capture the initiative of being the peacemaker. He can't capture the initiative because he's got, or from the religious community, because he's got so many of the religious community against him. I should have brought out a wonderful memo. I forget which of the missiles he was talking about here, but there was a memo from the president that hereafter this missile will be known as the Peacekeeper.
Yeah,
that's it, right. And it's going to be a peacekeeper because I say it's going to be a peacekeeper, and by definition, therefore, it's become a peacekeeper. And it hasn't caught on.
I think the reason he can't get his rhetoric straight, and neither can the people who write speeches, is that you have a very hard time really reconciling Christ with killing.
Yeah.
And I wish that maybe someone here could help me. There is a paradox in the reasoning of the far right, including the guy who wrote the late great Planet Earth.
Oh, Hal Lindsey. I'll talk about him Friday, right?
Now, I wish somebody would. I wish someone would help me with something that I really can't understand. I'll use Hal Lindsey in that book, and I read it a long time ago. But he gave all this information and all these scriptures and things, and then toward the end of the book, he says, "Now, here's the way that there's two ways that the Bible is unclear, and there's two ways that this could conclude." And then he gets into this pre-trib and post-trib and those kinds of things. And then he tells you both ways, but he tells you which way he believes to be right.
Right.
And the way he believes to be right is that there's going to be this terrible war, and that's going to be the end. And then he spends the last part of his book, here the man says this is God who's doing this and behind this, and this is the way God intends. And then he spends the last part of his book saying, now let's head God off. And get this stopped. Let's get the weapons to stop the Russians. And I don't understand that. The right to say, they're so religious, and I'm not against that. But they get this killing in with it.
Well, that's about page 8 on what I'm going to be talking about Friday. So, once you accept this, what we call hermeneutics, or this way of interpreting scripture, then you have to say that this is going to happen, because unless it happens this way, then everything else in the scripture can't be interpreted except in this totally literalistic kind of way. But there really will be probably only 144,000 people, and then, you know, the mark of the beast will be on it.
But then why try to head God off?
Well, they would say that this is, you know, this is the way God has promised us. We can't question or doubt this, because otherwise, once you start, you know, this is the old fundamentalist, mentality, once you question one iota of fact in the scriptures, then, you know, it's like the camel and the nose of the camel is in the tent. Then it all falls apart. But so they interpreted this as having to happen in this particular way.
But unless I misread the book, and if I did talk to you too, because we were both confused, it seems then he's saying that now there is this danger and Russia's going to start it.
Right.
So the thing we must do is be stronger than Russia and do all these things so that Russia can't start it. But if you really believed that God's going to conclude this, wouldn't you just stand aside and say this is...
They have, I think, simply a wrong doctrine of the Incarnation, because they really believe that the earth is Satan's, and that Satan is going to come right to the brink of victory as prophesied. Then all this is going to happen, this terrible stuff is going to happen, Armageddon is going to happen, because only when Satan, who is that powerful, can be defeated by an even more powerful God, can the full power, the omnipotence of God be proven. God can't have just an ordinary pop gun little kind of rival out there. God has to have somebody who comes almost that close to being as powerful as God himself. Yeah, see, and that's why all the, that, that, yeah, that's the explanation. You know, I,
And isn't that where it really gets scary? Is people like Watt says some of the things that he does, and you get some military general who says, okay, you know, I'm a Bible believer, and why don't we go ahead and get the thing over with, and pushes the button.
That's he's trying to prevent it, though.
Yeah, that's the explanation.
That Lindsay would be, but I'm saying, someone else who could step in at that point in a military power role and say, let's parade along.
That's the doctrinal or the scriptural reason why, and because God is, and it's sort of a Calvinist, neo-Calvinist idea about the omnipotence of God. You always have to find evidences that God is powerful. Lindsay can't accept the ordinary, everyday, demonstrations of God's working through nature. He always needs some spectacular sort of thing to prove it. That's where the trouble is.
It's almost as if...
You mentioned that the churches would have to get the ball rolling in terms of... nuclear war thing. I guess I'm asking a question about the mechanics of the thing. Let's assume that the churches all march, so to speak, on Washington, D.C. We join our voices together in unison and say, we want no more war. We want no more nuclear building. We want to dismantle what we already have and disarm the major powers of the world. Are we saying that the political structures, the realities we're dealing with, are going to listen to them if all the churches are united, and that they're going to say, okay, we're going to do it?
Well, you can only witness to what you believe. And if you believe in, I remember a couple of years ago Mary made that point so well in here when we got talking about politics, that if you believe something, you witness to it. And if, it's just like, should I have voted, I'll say my own example here, knowing John Anderson would lose, should I vote for him, anyway, because I really believed more in his program than anybody else's, even though I thought that might be throwing it away and therefore it might be, it might be a vote for Reagan. But I believed in what John Anderson, was advocating. And so I witnessed to that. And I think that's what the church, that's what I would say with the churches. You witness to what you believe.
And our hope is that the political structures would take us seriously and listen to it.
It has happened, not very often, but it has happened.
Also the economic structures.
Yeah.
Because the economic structures, the people who run them also go to church, sort of.
Yeah. But you can get involved. A favorite example of mine is a sociologist, he's dead now, but he was, I think this is relevant today, is when he wrote, his name is C. Wright Mills. And Mills was talking about what he, in the late 50s, was talking about what he called crackpot realism. The armament people and the pro-military people and all the rest say we have to be realistic. And he calls he says these are the, these are the nuts, they're not the realists, this is crackpot realism. The real, the true realists are those who believe that something can be done, and you just don't accept sort of an inevitable fatalism in life, that there'll be wars and rumors of wars.
Now, for the purposes of his congregation,
sure.
If you were, are you a minister?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, how do you counteract that when you say, all right, so we disarm and we agree and we do this and Russia does not, because that accusation was made that Carter sold down the river through the salt things, and the detente worked for the Russians, but not for us. Reagan made lots of mileage out of that and was elected on that almost as much as the economics.
Yeah.
Now, how do you answer that?
Yeah. Now, if correct me if I'm wrong on this, but isn't the Catholic statement that they want mutual and verifiable, disarmament? Isn't that the phrase that's being used, mutual? That is, it has to be done two by two. I mean, both countries together. Mm-hmm. And it has to be verifiable. And I think, that comes back to tactics. That would be the first step. But you always keep the pressure up on, for going beyond that. But I think until there is the confidence that something, is going to be done, that we aren't going to be, quote, duped. Because I'm so afraid, I study your radical ideological movements on the right and left, and what I'm so afraid of is that what is going to what can happen in this movement is that the feelings are so strong that the Friesniks, as Falwell likes to call us, the Friesniks are going to start arguing more among themselves. And there have been a lot of good movements that have failed because they started arguing among themselves.
Disunity within.
Yeah, and one reason, and the major, I think, reason Reagan won in 1980 was that all the different conservative groups came together this one time.
Yeah.
Conservatives are already splitting. Richard Viguerie and his New Right, and with some of the others, are already parting, you know, from they saying Reagan isn't conservative enough. I'm delighted, you know, personally. You see, I do take a stand. You see, okay. So, you know, people with strong ideological and religious feelings usually like to argue among themselves more than they like to argue, you know, with their adversaries. And that's the one thing I'm afraid of. I think that's true.
I was just going to say, I think we have to make a point, though, that our morality cannot be linked to that of others, to the political actions of others. And so it disturbs me a lot when people will say that they're for disarmament, but only if the Russians disarm them. Because at that point, you're equating morality with political action, and the two cannot be equated. The fact is, nuclear weapons are wrong, and so I think that we pursue disarmament with the hope that others will join us.
We see that's the first crack in the, you know, in the armor right there.
What is this?
In unity.
Well, in unity, but the thing is that unity, you. If nuclear weapons are indeed wrong, you don't justify them that somebody else has them, that the Russians have them or that the Chinese have them.
Then you're enjoying the luxury of absolutism, of saying that everything, you know, that you do is wrong and I'm pure, therefore I'm not going to have anything to do with you.
Can we not agree that nuclear weapons
are sure, they're wrong, and you go after them, but you go after them in a way that can be done, and not taking an absolutist stand and saying I'm not going to have anything to do with you. What? I have to vote for somebody. I have a commitment to vote. What? That wasn't an absolute.
You absolutely threw it away.
Well, not really.
No, it's the same thing. You're just talking against yourself.
There were a lot of us who voted for Anderson because we felt that we wanted to send a message to the two political parties that it was time they started listening to a lot of us out here. Our voice was not being heard, and even if it goes to a third party in the next election, we wanted them to know we were unsatisfied with the candidates.
And then you're setting yourself over here and saying, I won't have anything to do with these two parties.
That's our right.
I just see them, you know.
The way I voted for Anderson also, I worked for his campaign, I threw away my vote also. I've never been among so many Anderson supporters. Only this many people.
I found the other one in Minnesota who voted.
I don't see that as absolutism. Just as I don't see it as absolutism, the fact that you realize that we are disarmed, and it's not a disruption of unity if you are prepared to disarm, and you are certainly working as hard, and you're not dismissing people. These people want to work with other people. But I think we have to keep it clear in our own minds that you proceed with disarmament with the fact that you're doing the right thing, and that you don't stop disarming because somebody else has stopped disarming. But the fact is that you continue to always put on the pressure.
You're not for the mutual part of it.
Well, I don't. What it is the mutual part of it is fine. I think it's essential that we mutually disarm. But the fact is that we can't link our disarmament to somebody else. If you guys don't go with us, we're not going to go at all.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, morally, you're right. But tactically, you might be committing suicide.
That's right.
And that's what
that's
I think
right.
the Anderson vote did.
Well, I guess my feeling is that at some point we...
commit suicide.
Well,
yep.
No.
Is it
committing suicide? I have to look at Raoul Wallenberg. I have to look at Zimmerman down in Brazil. But they were doing the right thing, and they did the right thing.
Let's get Mr. Halverson here. I'm sorry? I thought you somebody else. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well,
whatever.
The problem that I have with all this is that if all the nuclear weaponry of all kinds was suddenly to disappear, we're still in one hell of a mess in this world. So we really aren't facing the basic issue. We're just talking to some senators. So I say, why don't we, if we're going to add church members, become actively involved in something, let's get involved in what the basic root cause is. What we're talking about is whether we're going to throw big rocks or little rocks or dozens of rocks at each other. That's all we're talking about. We're talking about the size of the rocks. We haven't even begun to discuss the real basic problem. If you look at the map of the world, there's something going on in practically every country, either internal conflict, border conflict, Afghanistan, and so forth.
Okay.
We haven't even talked about that.
Because my faith tells me that we'll never, you know, achieve perfection. We'll never achieve
that sort of thing.
And therefore, we have to make the world not as perfect as possible, but eliminate the worst possible, you know, quality of features in the world. And certainly, the one that strikes me right away is radioactivity. There are differences. It isn't just big bombs and big rocks and little rocks. Radioactivity is something that never existed before, you know, before Hiroshima.
If you get hit by a bomb, it doesn't make you hit.
No,
because
the
or what is it?
Because of the clean,
dead.
If you want to call it the clean bomb, that's the end of it. Radioactivity affects people for...
I don't want bombing. I'm too big a coward.
Yeah. But you see, there is a difference between bombs. That's what I'm saying.
That's right.
Well, there is a real difference between bombs.
Is napalm better than... or
and that's another
bad
one. That's the despicable one, too. But what I'm trying to say is that we have to concentrate on the ones right now that are going to... That can contaminate the world forever. TNT isn't going to, you know, damage, you know, crops, for instance, forever. Yeah.
I think what you're saying is that peacemaking is more active and positive than disarmament.
Oh, sure.
And that,
sure. Yeah, fine. I would agree with that. Fine.
And that social justice is the ultimate cause.
Yeah, far right.
That,
goal, sure.
That peacemakers work for
right.
Social justice.
Fine.
As a way to avoid conflict.
Right. Okay. I go
and
along with
that.
That
is the reason that
yeah.
So many things are going on all over the world is the crying lack of
okay.
Social justice.
And who's better able to handle? Who's better able to speak to that?
Well, I don't trust those who claim they have all the facts and
it
that
the church.
The church, or
church,
sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Church
should
the
be the church,
and then
the church is uniquely the
right. And then what happens? To take an example, maybe they didn't get around, but one that bothers me very much is when the National Council of Churches does take a stand, then people like Morley Safer, with all his power, and the Reader's Digest, with all his power, calls them pro-communist.
Mm-hmm. And blessed are you when they revile you and persecute you for righteousness'
yeah.
sake.
Right, but then all the donations to the National Council fall off even farther.
Yeah.
You can't serve both God.
Right.
Then
yes. Yeah, and I'll grant you that sometimes there are some pretty airheaded programs that the National Council has funded. I have no, you know, illusions about that. But on the other hand, they, you know, I think their record basically is far more constructive. Yeah.
From a political standpoint, do you think we are closer or farther away from being able to sit down with representatives from Russia? And really seriously talk about, you know, disarmament and dystopia.
Well, I think Andropov has tried to make a change from what existed before, from Brezhnev. I really think he's tried to make a change.
He's coming off with a softer stance?
I think he's coming off with a more open stance than it was before.
I think he scares fiddlers by Brezhnev.
I think he does.
Would you anybody that's got a brain
in? Yeah.
Including me. If we're frightened of him in our country, can you imagine what we'd be like if...
Yeah. And we don't know how much political posturing has to go on, you know, in the public arena. Whereas the real work is being done, you know, probably on a lower echelon. And all we are given is, you know, letters to little 10-year-old girls and, you know, things like that. And,
but we do hear him rattling sabers.
Oh,
he rattles our sabers.
Oh, yeah, our sabers
else.
Too. No, I think there has been a change how much. I'm not, you know, a criminologist there. Because one of my colleagues, two doors away, Bob Nichols, is a criminologist and Russian history, and that's his title, but he's crossed a bear. But I would think that there is some positive.
My particular feeling is until Russia is really seriously and you know, I'd like to join this gentleman over here, but I really can't buy that. I have a feeling that if I'm the only one sitting in this room, and the rest of you all have 45 automatic straps to the side of you, you know, and I know that. And I heard the night before that someone was killed by someone with 45. I think I'd come with an automatic 45 in this room myself, just by recent self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the business of everyone throwing down their guns is a good idealization, but I don't think that's where things are at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You probably have something to respond to that.
Well, I guess I just would say, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'd come in with a 45 too. But at some point.
Yeah.
I'm so tired of it always being. It, what it does is it takes responsibility off of yourself and puts it on somebody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You may be ahead of us about 10 years. You know, we might get that.
Yeah.
We might get that.
But I think that this is what we have to talk about because another stray thought floating around my head. Politics is not the answer to nuclear weapons. Never has and never will be. And as long as we maintain talking about politics, I'm talking about nuclear weapons strictly on a political level, we're never going to get anywhere. That's not to say that political action is not important, but it's not the answer. And so, just as peace can't be made by building more missiles, you can't ever get to the morality of nuclear weapons through the politics.
That's what we were saying last night.
Yeah.
It finally has to become a religious commitment about this. And I mean, it's got to be religious.
Right.
It's got to be a moral, religious commitment about this. And it's got to be in the heart.
Right.
You're not going
to... And we've been here an hour now. That's a good place to take a break for those who, you know, the policy of Poland is that a program like this goes for an hour, and for those who might want to, for whatever reason, leave, this would be an opportunity to do so without embarrassment to anybody. And anybody who wants to stay, I'd be delighted to stay on too. Well,
I keep noticing that when it's economic, or when it has to do with jobs, which is the same as to say economics, that things happen. And so somehow, and that's why I think that tax resistance is a valid method in this particular case, because there doesn't seem to be any other economic way that anybody can think of to get at ourselves, our own taxing of ourselves to make these missiles. If we don't want them, at some point we have to find an economic way to say no to our own government. And I don't know of any other way except through the taxes.
Yeah, that's the one. You know, that has worked before. I mean, we did it against England in 1776.
Yeah, but we had to have a revolution.
We had to have a, then we had to go to war to back it up, too. Yeah,
we had
to.
That's a good question. Did we have to go to war?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I doubt it. I really doubt it.
Well, I teach American history, and I don't want to, you know, get into my little bag.
I want a peace academy, so we can study.
There is one going. In fact, I hope you get in touch with, what's her name in Chelan? Holly Wells. She's been up here several times. Maybe you've met Holly.
No, but I know about her.
Okay, and she's very strong on the peace academy. And she knows a lot about it. She's right down the lake.
She isn't actually one in existence yet, is there?
No, but it's gotten support from people across the political spectrum.
In terms of a historian, what was your interpretation of Carter's intervention in the Near East with the Egyptian, Sadat and that type of thing?
Well,
where do you think was the financial, what do you think was the political runoff on that?
Well, I think in a way it was when were you in Bible study this morning with Dan? It was one of those serendipitous moments when Sadat and Begin met. And one of those rare things, it's like de Gaulle and Adenauer.
One of those well-timed historical events.
Right, and maybe Carter helped, maybe he didn't. But whatever, it did happen, and it could have. I think if Sadat had been able to live, it could have been continued. Because I think Sadat had a presence. I guess that's the word, if you want to call it charisma or whatever. But Sadat had a presence that you need in this world, and that very few people have. But then if we've been going, some of you know, we've been going in this. This week on whether or not there is demonic power loose in the world, and clearly there had to be demonic power loose when Sadat was assassinated. I think, I really think that's the forces of particularism and localism and all the rest. And we can't, the one thing with a historian, we only deal with the past, and we can't talk about what if. Everything else, but I think that Sadat had a way about him, whatever you want to talk, whatever way you want to say it. And now I haven't seen the paper for about a week or something, but apparently the war clouds are looming ominously again, and there doesn't seem to be any one person, and certainly Begin isn't the one to some people forget that Begin was an old terrorist, and he saw nothing of using force. He was the one who helped blow up the King George, the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. He's an old bomber from way back. And if you need to knock out the Iraqi reactor plant, then just send some jets over to do it. That's just another way of doing. I don't want to get going on that, but I think that's a Hubert Humphrey answer, answer.
When I visited the United Nations last summer,
the girl who led our tour said that almost in any given week there are seven wars, small wars going on all at all times. And when we talk about world peace, this older gentleman was mentioning, you know, we're thinking about the United States and Russia, and we're talking about the church, but we're talking about the Christian church, and we're in the minority in the world. How do we tap in the resources of the Buddhists and all of these majority sects or religions? China has a potential for a bomb. We're talking about us and the Russians, but how are we going to persuade religious groups in China, for example, that this is important to all of us? You know, we're limiting the scope of our activities just to Christian churches. But we have to get those people involved too, and
what's so frightening?
That has to be one of our goals.
What's so frightening is that, for instance, with Islam, you can make a very good case that Islam needs and thrives on war.
What about us?
Yeah.
Man, we do real well. We're making those things, you know.
Because Islam nationalism, you know, the last 20 years has just been rampant, and it's always, it always advances, you know, with force.
Well, what about the ones that, where do they give it, that we can work with? How are we going to work with those people? That's where we've got to start building relationships with. All right.
And Sadat, you know, had that, had to have that bridge ability.
Right.
I think that was.
Maybe we should start sending letters again.
It really was, right, yeah.
It seems to me, I don't know, I'm no political theorist or, you know, can gaze in any crystal ball, I guess no one can. But in terms of any kind of reality, in terms of, you know, de-escalation and this type of thing, or dismantling them, and really putting the toys of war back in the box. I don't see any hope outside of the fact that the major powers that have control over this kind of weapon, the only way there's going to be any kind of significant change is that when we get to the negotiating table, we seriously can understand some of the plight that all of us stand in at this point.
Yeah.
And say, let's put all our cards on the table and say, now this is it.
Well,
until that day comes, I can't foresee any. I don't care how united churches or Christians together throughout the world become. Who's going to listen to it if we can't negotiate, if we can't talk, if we can't trust one another, if we can't say, let's knock out the insanity and let's put the toys back in the box? It's the minimum.
We're going to have Compline in here, so.
Yeah, but what about.
I don't know. How do the rest of you feel about that?
I agree.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of things.
And of course, the difficulty with Russia is the fact that we haven't been able to trust them, and they in turn, don't seem to be able to trust
them. Yeah, but we give away our nuclear knowledge to just all over the place. We've promoted nuclear power plants all over the place, and they've gotten the technology from us.
I listed this morning six different kinds of arms limitation treaties that we in the Soviet Union have signed, and both have been keeping pretty well ever since, including the SALT II that we're keeping but won't sign.
Thank you.